Most of the building's cubicles were empty, without voices, telephones ringing, or the tapping of keystrokes. Tracy knew the missing persons unit from her time working with CSI in the same building. She'd also worked with Talia Greenwood, Katie Pryor's predecessor, on several missing persons cases. Greenwood had told Tracy that the unit never considered a case hopeless or closed. Greenwood either found the missing person or the case lingered in an open file on her computer. Tracy thought that a depressing and thankless task, a job you brought home at night, a job that could consume you each time you read or heard that another person went missing or a body was found, a job you could never escape. Greenwood once told Tracy she was only partially correct. As emotionally taxing as the job could be, Greenwood said she'd also experienced many good moments. Most people reported to be missing weren't actually missing. They'd often been arrested and sent to the county jail, or they'd been hurt and taken to a hospital. Others just wanted to get lost for a while, when everyday life became too much for them to bear, which was perhaps insensitive to those who loved them, but not illegal. And therein lay the first problem. How long did a young woman need to be missing before she was considered missing? What circumstances had to exist for a person to be missing and not just taking a break from life? SPD constantly seemed to be refining the answers to those questions. "Knock, knock," Tracy said. Pryor swiveled in her chair, stood, and gave Tracy a smile and a hug. "Tracy, hey, thanks for coming down." Her voice was soft, high-pitched, and reminded Tracy of a schoolgirl's. It had only been a few years since Tracy met Pryor at the shooting range to help her pass her qualification exam, but already Pryor's laugh lines were a bit more pronounced and her hips fuller. "Sorry it took longer than expected. How are the kids?" Tracy asked.
"Everyone is doing well. Can you believe my oldest will be starting middle school in the fall?"
Pryor shook her head, the same way Kins had when he'd told Tracy that his oldest was leaving for college. "You ever think about that? Where the years went?" Tracy asked. Pryor laughed.
"Only on special occasions, like birthdays and Christmas. On a day-to-day basis, my husband and I are just trying to keep the ship afloat. This job has really helped. I can plan around my kids' schedules, be home to help them with homework, and pick them up after their practices. It's been a godsend. It really has."
"I'm glad to hear it," Tracy said. And then, maybe because they'd broached the topic of kids, she added, "Because I'm going to be faced with that problem soon."
"You're pregnant?"
Pryor asked, her voice rising with disbelief. Tracy knew that part of Pryor's surprise related to Tracy's age, and likely a perception that Tracy had either chosen not to have children or couldn't conceive.
"Just completed my 16th week."
Pryor smiled.
"Oh my God," she said. "That's fantastic."
She looked down at Tracy's belly.
"I never would have guessed. You look terrific."
Coming from a mother of two, Pryor's comment made Tracy wonder again how Gonzalez had so quickly deduced her pregnancy.
"I don't always feel terrific," she said, "and I'm keeping it quiet for now." "I won't say anything. Do you know the sex?"
"No," Tracy said. "Dan doesn't want to find out. He said it's the last real surprise in life, and I guess I agree with him." Pryor smiled.
"I'm happy for you."
"It will complicate things," Tracy said. It already had.
"Don't worry about work, Tracy. You're not the first woman with a job who has had a child. Did I tell you the story about the time when I was 7 months pregnant with my second and still working patrol?"
"I don't think so."
"My sergeant, who had a gut out to here," Pryor said, extending her arms and hands to simulate a bulging stomach, "actually had the nerve to ask how I was going to put on my gun belt. You know what I told him?"
"No," Tracy said, though she was already laughing.
"I said, the same way you do, Sergeant."
They both laughed.
"We never had that conversation again," Pryor said.
She looked up at the clock on the wall.
"Okay, I know you're pressed for time. We can talk more about babies later. I got you a seat."
Tracy wheeled the chair closer to the computer and sat beside Pryor, who handed her a multi-page document,
then turned to her keyboard and typed. Tracy studied the missing persons report, which also appeared on Pryor's screen. Soft music played from Pryor's computer. "The missing woman's name is Kavita Mukherjee," Pryor said. 24 years old, a graduate of the University of Washington with a degree in chemistry. "I like her already," Tracy said. She'd been a high school chemistry teacher before joining the police force. So, no dummy. "Definitely not. Her former roommate, Aditi Dasgupta, sent me the photograph you're looking at." Pryor enlarged the photograph on her computer screen, which was cleaner and less grainy than the printed copy. Mukherjee reclined on a couch. She wore a black t-shirt and jeans with holes in the knees. Her toenails were painted a bright red. "Beautiful girl," Tracy said. "She's 5 feet, 10 inches tall and 130 pounds, with dark brown hair and blue eyes." "Blue eyes? That's got to be rare for her nationality." "I thought the same thing. It's uncommon for someone of Indian descent, but it does happen."
"You said she and the roommate were friends?"
"Since childhood. The past 4 years, they've been roommates."
Tracy sat back, content to let Pryor tell her what she'd learned.
The front door to the apartment opened slowly. Kavita Mukherjee, reclining on the sofa in the living room, slapped closed the novel she'd been reading, tossed it into the air, and shouted, "Aditi!" She jumped from the couch and rushed the door, ignoring Aditi's suitcases and embracing her best friend in a bear hug. Aditi had left earlier that summer to attend a cousin's wedding in India, then had stayed several months, traveling. She and Kavita had rarely been apart since childhood.
"It's so good to have you back," Kavita said. "Was it really 12 weeks? It feels as if you have been gone forever, and look at you."
She touched the silk of Aditi's green and yellow sari.
"You look so different. Did you buy this over there?"
"Let me guess. Your mother bought it for you." Kavita laughed and rolled her eyes. "She never gives up, does she?"
"No," Aditi said, smiling. "She never does."
They were both 24 years old, Kavita the older by a couple of months, and already their mothers were harping on them to settle, which meant get married. Forget that neither had a serious boyfriend. In fact, that was preferred. It made Kavita and Aditi that much more attractive to the list of suitors their mothers had started to compile, even before they'd completed their undergraduate education. Not that Aditi or Kavita were having any of it.
"Here, let me help you."
Kavita picked up the last of 3 large suitcases still in the hall.
"No, it's..." Aditi said, reaching for the case. "It's so light," Kavita said.
"Someday you'll have to teach me to pack." She set the suitcase down beside the two in the entryway and pulled Aditi into the living room. They'd rented the apartment in the university district after their sophomore year at the UW. They lived in the dorms their first 2 years but wanted something of their own. The furnishings were a hodgepodge of borrowed and gifted furniture and what they could get for next to nothing. A gray leather couch, a brown cloth chair, and an assortment of lamps, which they rarely used in the summer months when it stayed light past 9 at night. From their 5th-floor, eastern-facing apartment, they had views of the UW campus, Lake Washington, and, on clear days such as this, the snow-capped Cascade Mountains. Tonight, the sound of buses and cars filtered up from the Ave through the open windows.
"So come on!"
Kavita sat, folding her bare feet beneath her. She wore jeans with holes in the knees and a purple University of Washington t-shirt.
"Tell me all about your trip. How was your cousin's wedding? Did you get sick from the food? I'll bet it was hot. You must have been out of internet range because I didn't get any of your messages the last 2 weeks. I'm just so glad to have you back."
She leaned forward and the two women embraced. "It was nice," Aditi said. She looked understandably tired after traveling halfway around the world.
"Nice? It was nice?" Kavita laughed.
"Always the woman of few words," she slapped at Aditi playfully.
"Tell me about the wedding. Was the rest of your family surprised to see you? I'll bet they were surprised at how much you've matured."
"They were surprised," Aditi said. She dropped her gaze to her hands, which she'd folded in her lap. Kavita got an uneasy feeling that something was wrong. Aditi was more than a friend and a roommate. The two women were like sisters. They knew each other's moods. "What's wrong? What's the matter?" Kavita asked. But even as she spoke, her eyes, no longer filled with excitement, considered Aditi more carefully, and she fixated on the gold necklace with the black beads, then noticed the red dot just beneath Aditi's hairline. Kavita looked down at Aditi's open-toed sandals. Rings adorned several of her toes, much more than a young woman's fashion statement. The realization hit her like a punch to the gut. She could barely get the words out, suddenly nauseated.
"You're married?"
She said the words as if not believing them, not wanting to believe them, wanting to be wrong. Aditi raised her gaze to meet Kavita's. Tears trickled down her cheeks, but she tried to smile through them. Kavita let go of her friend's hands.
"I don't understand," she quickly added. "Is that why you went home?"
Aditi shook her head.
"No, no, Vita. It was just a visit to attend my cousin's wedding." "But what happened? My emails?"
"I met Rashesh at the wedding, and afterward, just a day or two, he came and spoke with my father. My relatives arranged it all."
"Who is he?" Kavita said.
"He's an engineer," Aditi said, "from Bangladesh, but he works in London. His father and my father have been friends since they were boys. They grew up in the same village. That's why his family was at my cousin's wedding."
The information seemed as if it was assaulting Kavita from a dozen different angles. She felt dizzy and disoriented.
"An arranged marriage?"
She shook her head, disbelieving.
"But we said we would never agree to it.
We both said we'd never agree to it."
They'd sworn an oath, a silly little oath in a fort they'd built in the state park when they'd been schoolgirls, but an oath they had renewed over the years. It had become a lifeline that had provided them strength when their parents persisted in trying to arrange their weddings, and when Kavita and Aditi refused to acquiesce, when their parents would no longer pay the apartment rent or for postgraduate study. Aditi gripped Kavita's hands, speaking softly, as if talking to a hurt little girl.
"We were just kids, Vita. We were just little girls."
Kavita pulled her hands away and wiped tears from her cheeks. She looked at the suitcases. Another shockwave rolled over her.
"They're empty, aren't they? You're not here to move home. You're here to move out."
Aditi nodded, now openly weeping.
"My parents and my husband are waiting downstairs. I asked them to let me break the news to you. I'm sorry, Vita. I can pay the rent until you find someone to take my place. I can..."
Kavita stood and turned from her. The word husband had not rolled off Aditi's tongue naturally. It sounded awkward, like she was pronouncing a foreign language and was uncertain she'd got it right.
"It's not about the rent, Aditi. We agreed. We..."
"I'm not like you, Vita. I'm not as strong as you. I can't do what you're doing."
Kavita turned to her.
"What about medical school?"
"I have my place now."
"What place? Following a man around you hardly know? Moving in with his family and cleaning up after them? Waiting on them like some servant? Like the good Indian wife?"
Aditi looked as if the last words pierced her.
"I'm sorry, Vita. I know you don't understand."
"Of course I don't understand. My best friend goes home for a visit and comes back married and you didn't even invite me?"
It was like another punch, a round of blows threatening to knock her down.
"I didn't go to India intending to get married, Vita. You have to believe me. It was only after we met at the wedding. And I liked him. A week later, the invitations were printed. 2 weeks after that, we were married."
Kavita paced before the open windows.
"My invitation must have gotten lost in the mail."
Another thought gained clarity, and she turned to her friend.
"You ignored my emails. The internet was fine. You just didn't want to answer them because you didn't want to lie to me."
Aditi remained seated.
"I didn't invite you, Vita, because you wouldn't have understood.
You would have tried to talk me out of it. You're damn right I would have tried to talk you out of it. This is insanity. You were going to be a doctor. We talked about it for years. Pediatricians, opening a practice together. I would have asked you if you'd lost your mind, if your mother had slipped something into your drink when you weren't looking. I would have called the embassy and told them you were being held captive against your will. What were you thinking?
I wasn't thinking, Vita. Not about getting married. Not until I met him.
Kavita stopped basing. She didn't want to hear it.
Please don't tell me this was, what, love at first sight?
Love comes in time.
Stop. Just stop. Do you hear yourself? My God, you sound like your mother. Like my mother.
She switched to a Bengali accent.
No man marries willingly, Kavita. He does it out of attraction, or for money, or to keep a family obligation. Money is spent, attraction fades, but stability is built through family.
She dropped the accent.
So what was it, Aditi? Money? Did your parents sell you off to him? A big dowry he couldn't resist? Or was it to keep a family obligation?
Aditi lowered her gaze, weeping. Kavita gritted her teeth, regretting what she'd said. She'd always been quick to anger, a bad trait when accompanied by a sharp tongue that cut before she could curtail it. She sat and pressed her forehead to her best friends, the way they had always done, the way they did when they'd made their pact.
I'm sorry, Diti. I didn't mean it. I'm just so stunned. I didn't mean it.
After a moment, Aditi raised her gaze.
I like him, Vita. I liked him from the moment I saw him.
Kavita shook her head.
But do you love him, Diti? Are you hopelessly in love and you can't fathom living a day without him? Do you feel that way about him, Diti? Do you?
Aditi sat back. Her words came with a bite.
And how has that worked out for you, Vita?
How has it worked out for me? We're only 24. We were going to graduate school.
How many boyfriends have I had, Vita?
Aditi persisted.
What?
Aditi shook her head but maintained her gaze and her resolve.
I'm not like you. I don't look like you and I don't have your personality. I didn't do as well as you in school.
You are going to medical school, Vita. But what if I don't get in? What if my MCATs are not as good as yours? What then? You're beautiful, Diti, and you're smart. Of course you'll get in.
Aditi's voice rose in volume and increased in intensity.
No, Vita, I'm not.
She took a deep breath that fluttered in her chest.
I'm not smart. Not like you. I just work harder. And I'm not beautiful. Especially not here. Aditi!
Aditi raised her hand.
Stop, Vita.
We go out and men flock to you and your light skin.
Me? They talk to me because I'm there. Like a houseplant.
They think that if they talk to me long enough, they might get the chance to talk to you.
That's not true.
Yes, Vita, it is true, she said, her voice becoming ever more adamant.
Look at you. You're tall and thin, and you have fine features, and those blue eyes. Men love your blue eyes. You can talk to anyone about anything, and they'll listen.
She shook her head.
I'm the awkward obligation. The person they have to talk to if they want to talk to you. It's been that way all our lives. All my life I've taken a backseat to you. And I was happy to do it. Happy to just be your friend.
She tapped her chest with a closed fist.
But this man, Rashesh, he saw me, and he liked what he saw. Do you know how that made me feel?
Kavita didn't want to hurt her friend. She didn't want to tell her that Rashesh might not have liked what he saw at all. In India, it was not about love at first sight. It wasn't even about love. It was about societal pressure placed mostly on girls and their parents, but also on men. The older a young woman got, the greater the apprehension that she would not marry, and the greater the suspicion that she had been ditched by some other suitor because she was too ambitious. Because she wasn't wife material, or because there was some dosh in her kundali, the
The stars weren't appropriately aligned at the time of her birth.
Something.
Kavita spoke, her voice barely above a whisper.
But he doesn't even know you, Titi.
Exactly, Vita, her friend said, eyes widening.
That is exactly my point. He didn't even know me, and yet he liked me.
He liked my dark skin and my flat nose and my overweight body. He didn't talk to me just so he could talk to you.
So why can't you be my friend now, Vita? Why can't you just be happy for me?
Because I hate to see you throw your life away like this.
But it's my life, Vita, Aditi said, striking her chest.
It's my life, and I can do with it as I please. Now who sounds like my mother telling me what is best for me?
But you're not Indian, Diti. I'm not Indian. We're American. We were born here in America.
I am Indian, Vita. To my very core, my very essence, I am Indian. Yes, I call this home, but why? My relatives do not live here, and I don't fit in.
Yes, you do, Diti.
No, Vita, no. She shook her head. I'm a minority here. You're a minority. Here, everyone notices the color of my skin. If I do well in school, it's dismissed as neurotic studying forced upon me by my compulsive, overachieving parents. Yes, I was born in this country, but I am still a stranger here. At least in India, no one questions the color of my skin. At least in India, the color of my skin is admired and respected, and yes, even liked. Men talk to me not because I was standing next to you. Not because I am the ugly sidekick they must get past. They talked to me because they liked me. Rishesh liked me.
They sat in silence, and the full ramifications of Aditi's decision began to wash over Kavita.
So you're moving to London? You're going to live there?
Yes.
With his family?
Yes.
Kavita wiped the tears from her eyes and inhaled and exhaled several deep breaths.
I'm sorry, Diti.
I'm sorry if I made you feel bad about yourself.
I didn't know how hard it's been for you. I never meant...
Aditi grabbed Kavita's hands and squeezed.
I know you didn't.
She smiled and again lowered her forehead until it touched Kavita's.
You can't help it if you're gorgeous.
Kavita laughed through her tears.
Are you happy, Diti? Really happy?
Aditi smiled, a genuine smile.
I am, Vita. I am happy. Would you like to meet him, my husband?
Kavita thought she would in time, but she didn't want to see Aditi's mother. Not now. Not today. Maybe not ever. Aditi's mother would be beaming, gloating. She'd throw Aditi's marriage in Kavita's face and in her mother's face. My God, she'd take great pleasure in extolling that Aditi was married, and to someone in their samaj, same religion and caste. While Kavita was still traipsing from one unfulfilling relationship to another, she'd gloat to Kavita's mother that Aditi would provide her with grandchildren, the fact that those grandchildren would grow up halfway around the world, and that she would see them maybe once or twice a year, was irrelevant when one was gloating, driving home a point like driving a stake through a vampire's chest.
I can't right now, Kavita said. I'm sorry, but I just can't. I'm going to leave so that you can move your things, so that I'm not in the way.
You're never in the...
Kavita leaned forward and gripped her friend in a fierce embrace, knowing it would likely be years before they saw one another again.
I'm going to miss you, Diti, she whispered.
And I'm going to miss you.
I'm going to miss you more than my parents and my brothers, Aditi said.
I am your sister, Diti, and you're mine. You were the sister I never had, the only sister I will ever have.
Weeping, Aditi said,
Promise me you will meet him. Promise me you will come to London and see me.
Kavita pulled away, overcome with emotion.
I can't.
Aditi clutched Kavita's shoulders.
Yes, Vita, you can. Please say it. I can't bear the thought of never seeing you again. Say it, please. Say you will come and visit me.
Kavita stifled her sobs long enough to answer.
Of course, Didi. Of course I'll come.
They released their embrace. Kavita stood. She knew leaving would be painful, but not as painful as a prolonged goodbye.
I have to go, she said, and she hurried from the apartment, her body racked with sorrow, fighting not to sob. She'd lost her sister.
Tracy blew out a short breath. That had to be a lot for somebody to take in, especially from someone she'd been friends with for so many years. Pryor nodded.
Dasgupta said there were a lot of tears, but that Mukherjee eventually expressed happiness for her.
Tracy glanced at the clock on the computer. She knew she'd kept Pryor from her family long enough, and she too was anxious to get home.
So Dasgupta thinks she's missing because she can't reach her on her cell? It goes straight to voicemail, and she hasn't responded to text messages or emails.
And we know that she's not at her parents' or staying with a friend?
I call the family, and I've reached most on the list of friends Dasgupta provided. Dasgupta also told me it was not likely Mukherjee would be with family. She said Mukherjee was estranged from her parents and rarely went home.
Because she wouldn't submit to an arranged marriage. Pryor nodded.
Dasgupta said Mukherjee was headstrong about it. So, apparently, is the mother. It's at a standoff.
Tracy continued through the missing persons report. Has anyone been to the apartment to see if her luggage or clothes are gone? Another nod.
Dasgupta went by the apartment when she couldn't reach Mukherjee by phone. She said nothing looked to have been taken, and there is no sign of forced entry or of a confrontation in the apartment.
Mukherjee hadn't been back to the apartment?
No, she apparently had been. That's what made Dasgupta so concerned. Dasgupta said she left Mukherjee a note and a gift, a sari she'd brought back from India. She said the note had been opened and the sari was spread across Mukherjee's bed.
So she'd come home at some point, but she didn't sleep in her bed if the sari and note were still on it?
Pryor nodded. That appears to have been the case.
Does she have a boyfriend? Tracy asked.
No.
Tracy pointed to the picture on the screen. A girl who looks like that? Pryor shrugged.
That's what Dasgupta told me.
What about an ex-boyfriend? Someone who could have harmed her? Pryor shook her head.
Nothing recent. Dasgupta and Mukherjee didn't have the time to get serious with anyone. After their families cut them off financially, Mukherjee was working whenever she could, trying to save for medical school.
Pryor looked at her computer, scrolling down the screen.
That's another thing. I spoke to the employer. It's a clothing store on the Ave. Mukherjee was scheduled to work this afternoon but didn't show up, which the employer said had never happened before.
Does she own a car? Could she have driven somewhere to get away and be alone?
She bought a 1999 Honda Accord after graduation. It's apparently a beater and she never drove it far. According to Dasgupta, it's still parked on the street near the apartment.
Tracy flipped another page of the report, considering the friends Pryor had already contacted. Then she said, So the roommate didn't have any idea where Mukherjee might have gone? Someplace she might have crashed?
She called their closest friends. No one has seen or heard from her.
And I assume you checked the county jail and hospitals?
First calls. No luck.
Tracy sat back. She might have just needed a break to process everything the roommate dumped on her. It's a lot to take in. She's married. She's moving out. She's moving to London.
I hope that's the case, Pryor said.
I do too. I'm not sure Nolasco is going to let me work this, Tracy said. Foz and Dell just pulled a murder in South Park, and Nolasco wants me to jump in when I'm out of the Stevenson trial.
I know you're busy over there, Pryor said. But like I said on the phone, sometimes you just get a feel for these things. And this one is bothering me.
Tracy gave it another moment of thought. I should be out of court tomorrow, she said. Set up a meeting with Dasgupta at the apartment for the afternoon. Tell her not to go in, just in case this is something more than it appears. 8. Tracy rolled her 1973 Ford F-150 truck up the gravel drive to their stone farmhouse in Redmond. The cloudless sky burned a deep orange along the horizon, and shadows crept up the surrounding hills and trees. Rex and Sherlock, their two Rhodesian Ridgebacks, barked when they heard the truck and bounded off the deck to greet her. Tracy had become accustomed to using the plural to describe ownership of the house and the dogs after so many years of using the singular pronoun. She shut off the engine and took a moment to decompress, thinking again of what Kins had said about having a child, about how things would change, that it was inevitable. Just this morning, Dan had fretted about the size of their farmhouse, with its single bathroom, lone bedroom, and tiny kitchen. "It's a baby," Tracy had said to calm him. "We're not adopting an elephant. We can worry about remodeling or moving later." But she, too, had moments of concern. She'd soon need a new wardrobe. She could no longer button her jeans with the baby bump, and her shoes and bras were tight. She looked around the interior of the truck cab. Though she kept the truck in mint condition, it didn't have airbags or shoulder belts or any of the other safety bells and whistles. She'd have to get a new car for the baby, something sturdy and maternal, like a Volvo or Subaru. Dan stepped out the sliding glass doors onto the deck. He held barbecue tongs. Tracy had called to tell him she'd be late, and he'd promised to have dinner waiting. He smiled at her from behind round, wire-rimmed sunglasses and clacked the tongs together playfully, as if to pinch her. Barefoot, Dan wore his cargo shorts and a Bruce Springsteen t-shirt he'd bought at the River Revival concert at Key Arena. Additional concerts would be on hold for a while. Tracy turned off the stereo and stepped down from the cab. She patted and rubbed the big dogs' heads and sides as they circled her, panting, tongues hanging from their mouths, their fur warm from the sun. Around them, the air buzzed and the brown grass crackled as if with static. Tracy climbed the steps, and she and Dan kissed. His sunglasses weren't the only similarity to John Lennon, the Beatles founder. Dan wore his hair long. The curls brushed the collars of his dress shirts. "You're certainly putting this deck to good use," Tracy said. Dan built the deck to give them more room. In the summer, he was usually grilling something. "Put a desk and a computer out here, and it could be your office." "How's our little tadpole doing?" Dan asked, placing a hand on Tracy's stomach. "Hungry," she said. "I just put the halibut on. Why don't you change?" She went to one of the Adirondack chairs where Roger, their cat, lay stretched out. When she rubbed his coat, he startled and scratched at her. "Fine, be that way," she said, shooing him from the chair and taking his place. "But don't come running to me tonight when I'm in bed." Tracy reached for a glass of iced tea and sipped it, grimacing at the bitter, unsweetened taste. "God, how do you drink this stuff without any sugar?" "Bad day in court?" Dan asked, clearly sensing her mood. "Court was fine, except I had to pee every 5 minutes." "Still?" She had questioned her doctor about her urgent need during the most recent exam, but he had assured her that the increased sensation was perfectly normal and caused by pressure on her bladder. It was all very clinical, but of little comfort. "It got worse when I went back to the office."
"Having to pee?"
"My day. I ran into my replacement in the bathroom." Dan flinched, as if he'd been the one pinched with the tongs. His eyebrows inched together above his glasses.
"I thought you didn't tell anyone except Kins."
"I didn't. But when I stepped into the bathroom, I bumped into a woman who said Nolasco had hired her to work with the A-team. I know I should be happy to have another woman in this section, but my initial impression is I'm not going to like her much." A buzzer sounded on Dan's phone. He shut it off, lifted the lid on the barbecue, which emitted smoke and the smell of herbs, and flipped the halibut, along with 2 ears of corn wrapped in foil. The top side of the halibut now displayed blackened strips. Dan spoke as he coated the fish with what looked and smelled like butter and garlic sauce.
"What about Ron Mayweather? I thought he was your fifth wheel."
"He is. Was. Nolasco said Ron opted to take a permanent position on C-Team. One of their detectives is retiring end of December." Dan gave a small shrug, reset the timer, and closed the lid.
"Maybe this woman won't be so bad."
"Maybe.
She's a good-looking Hispanic woman, which is reason enough for Nolasco to hire her.
Don't hold that against her.
I'm not. But I am wondering if he hired her to replace me when I go out on maternity leave, with the hope that I won't be back.
You might be giving him a little too much credit, don't you think? How would he know if you hadn't told anyone?
She clearly knew.
She did?
Called me on it about 5 seconds after I met her. Asked, how far along are you?
Tracy looked out at the dead grass.
I don't know, maybe you're right. Maybe I am making too much out of it. I know I can't hide being pregnant forever.
No, you can't. But Nolasco also can't fire you or give your position away. He isn't that dumb, is he?
I'd like to say no, but... Dan gave her a knowing look.
Something else bothering you?
Maybe it's just my hormones. But I'm tired of fighting this crap, Dan.
She rubbed Sherlock's head and kissed his nose. What are you saying? You don't want to go back after the baby's born?
I'm not saying anything. I'm just thinking things over.
Are you thinking about quitting?
She looked up at him. Why? Do you think I should quit?
I think you should do whatever you want.
Why'd you ask me?
Dan looked confused. Because you said you were tired of fighting the bullshit day in and out.
I am. And I'd like to tell you that I'd never give Nolasco the satisfaction of quitting, but yeah, I guess I am thinking about what to do when the baby is born.
Dan leaned his back against the railing. What brought this on?
Kins.
Kins? I would have thought he'd be the one trying to convince you to stay.
He said things change when you have a baby, that I might want to stay at home.
She took another sip of the tea and again grimaced.
Never understand why you don't add sugar, she said.
Not everyone is built the same, Tracy.
Are you talking about the iced tea or staying home when the baby is born?
Both, I guess. She stood to change out of her clothes. Maybe she was just hot and tired and hungry. Or maybe it was what Kins had said to her.
Realistically, this may be the only child we're ever going to have. I don't want to miss out on things because I'm working. Kins said that in a few months they'll be taking Connor off to college.
Is that what this is about? He's just emotional, Tracy, because his son is leaving.
No, she said. He's emotional because his son will no longer be living at home, and he wishes he could have spent more time with him. He told me not to feel bad if I want to stay home with our baby.
Well, maybe he's right. The alarm sounded. Dan shut it off but didn't immediately raise the barbecue lid.
I certainly don't mind, Tracy. We don't need your salary, but we also don't need to make the decision tonight. If you want to stay home when the baby's born, make that decision then. You'd be all right with it?
If that's what you decide you want to do.
She nodded to the barbecue. Don't burn that halibut.
9. Foz and Dell took the convenience store video to Park 95. The video unit would get to work in the morning and try to come up with a license plate number for the parked car, the white SUV, or both. Foz drove from Park 95 to his home in Green Lake. When he pulled down his driveway, he triggered the light on the cornice of the freestanding garage, and it illuminated the mounted basketball hoop and backboard. There had been years when Foz could not park in the driveway, back when Antonio was still playing basketball at St. John's Grammar School and later at Bishop Blanchet High School. Foz had loved those years, especially the summer nights when the neighborhood kids came over, and he and Vera fed them. They would have had half a dozen kids, but it wasn't meant to be. He and Vera had married later in life. Their first date had been set up by their parents, though they were quick to note that it hadn't been a blind date. Their families had been long-time acquaintances and had arranged for the two of them to meet for coffee. Foz fell in love at first sight. Vera said it took her longer, 3 dates. They were married 3 months from that first date, then decided it best they get to know one another before having their first child. When they'd started trying, Vera couldn't get pregnant. It took another year. After Antonio's birth, they tried for a second child, but when Vera again couldn't get pregnant, she went to the doctor.
They found a tumor in her uterus that tested malignant and required that she have her uterus removed, which ended talk of any more kids. The doctor said they'd been lucky, that if they hadn't been trying to get pregnant, they never would have found the tumor and it could have spread. Fuzz said it was love that had saved Vera's life, and they'd poured all of that love into Antonio, who now lived not far from them in Fremont. Fuzz stepped from the car, his sport coat draped over his arm. He'd loosened his tie and unbuttoned the collar of his shirt. At the back door, another light triggered. He'd installed that light for Vera, so she wasn't coming home in the dark during the winter months. He was searching for his house key on his key ring when Vera opened the door.
"I thought I heard you drive up," she said. "Were you on a phone call?"
"No," he said. "I was just thinking about all those years we couldn't bark in the driveway, because Antonio was playing basketball." Fuzz dropped his watch, keys, wallet, and cell phone in a basket by the back door, a habit so he wouldn't forget them in the morning. Vera smiled at the memory.
"Any leads on the shooter in South Park?" she asked.
Fuzz had called to let her know of the shooting and that he'd be home late.
"Maybe," he said. "Don't I get a kiss hello?"
Vera turned back and kissed him. He removed his tie and spoke as he walked into the adjacent dining room. He draped both the tie and his jacket over the back of a chair. He told her of the convenience store and the videotape showing the possible shooter.
"We might have caught a lucky break. The video unit is breaking the tape down for us tomorrow."
Vera turned toward the stove.
"Are you hungry? I made chicken Milano and polenta. Antonio gave me the recipe."
Antonio worked as a chef at an Italian restaurant and was saving money to open his own place. He intended to call it Fazio's. Fuzz almost cried when Antonio delivered the news.
"How about that?" he'd said to Vera. "I always knew I'd see my name in lights. Did you talk to him today?"
Fuzz pulled out a chair and sat at the kitchen table.
"How's he doing?"
He rolled up the cuffs of his sleeves.
"How about that girl he's been dating? Is he ever gonna propose?"
"I think he might." Fuzz stopped rolling his sleeve.
"Yeah?"
"He talked about it," Vera said. "He wants to wait until he has money to buy her a ring."
"That's no reason to wait. He loves her, he should marry her, like we did. We didn't wait. Turned out okay."
Vera laughed lightly.
"You just wanted to have sex."
"Yeah, but that's because I love you."
"Uh-huh," she said.
"Don't pressure him. I know you want grandkids, but he has a lot on his plate." "What pressure? I'm not pressuring him. Just thinking it would be nice if the grandkids put that hoop to good use."
"You want the chicken and polenta?" she asked.
"Do I want the chicken and polenta? Is the Pope single?"
Vera opened the oven door, and the room filled with the enticing aroma of lemon, butter, and garlic. Vera never used a microwave to warm Fuzz's meals. She said it made the chicken rubbery.
"Smells good," Fuzz said.
Vera set a plate and utensils in front of him.
"You tired?" "More frustrated than tired. I don't understand people anymore. Here a mother of two gets shot in front of her two small kids, and everyone in the apartment complex is keeping quiet."
"You said they're afraid?"
Vera set the chicken on a potholder on the table and scooped Fuzz a breast, then covered it with sauce.
"Looks good," he said, picking up a knife and fork. "There's a punk down there running the drugs. Hey, you remember Big Jimmy? I put him away for 25 years. He got stabbed in prison, you remember?"
"Not really."
"Well, the guy running things down there now is Little Jimmy, his son. Word on the street is he's crazy."
"I hate you working the gang cases."
"A convenience store owner told me and Dal that Little Jimmy put out the word that anybody says anything, they're going to end up like the woman."
Fuzz decided not to elaborate on seeing Little Jimmy, or the hand gesture Little Jimmy had made as the car drove past, which would only worry Vera. He cut into the chicken. Steam rose from his fork and his plate. He took a bite, and a burst of flavor filled his mouth.
"Tell Antonio he's got another winner. For real. This might be his best."
"You want wine?"
"Yeah," he said. "Not too much, though. Dell and I are going back out tomorrow morning."
He heard her opening the cabinet behind him and retrieving the bottle of Chianti and a glass, and noticed that Vera had not set herself a plate. Except when he was working night shift, she ordinarily waited so they could eat dinner together.
"You're not eating?"
Foz asked. When Vera didn't answer, he turned his chair. She stood at the counter, her back to him.
"Vera?"
"I ate earlier," she said, her voice soft.
"You go ahead."
He sensed something was not quite right, stood, and moved to her.
"You all right, Vera? What's wrong?"
She was crying, using a towel to wipe at tears.
"I had my mammogram this afternoon before I saw Antonio."
Foz felt a cold sweat that chilled him to the bone.
"That's right," he said, cautious. "Shit, I'm sorry, Vera. I should have asked you right away. How'd it go?"
He wasn't sure he wanted the answer, and when Vera didn't immediately respond, he got a pain in his gut. He put a hand on her shoulder and turned her.
"I have another mass, Vic. I felt it the other day. I didn't want to alarm you until I made the appointment."
Foz felt sick.
"What did the doctor say?"
She gave a small shrug.
"He said it's definitely a mass, and that the mammogram raised some questions."
"What kind of questions?"
"They don't know yet. They called this afternoon. They want me to come back for some additional screening."
"When?"
"Tomorrow morning, 8 o'clock.
"I'm coming with you."
"No, Vic, you have that shooting. You go to work. I know how busy you are."
"We gotta wait and see if they can enhance the video and get us a license plate," he said. "So I'm going with you." They both paused, and in the silence, Foz heard the humming of the refrigerator and the ticks and creaks of a home that had quickly grown old. He looked at Vera, uncertain what more to say.
"It's probably nothing, right?"
10. Wednesday, July 11th, 2018. It was noon when Leonard Litwin finally released Tracy and rested his case. Judge Gowan dismissed the jury with instruction to return at 2 p.m. for closing arguments. Tracy walked back to police headquarters rather than to Hotig's office. The closing argument was the prosecutor's alone to prepare and deliver, though she would be present to hear it. She'd given him what thought she had, for what they were worth. July had produced another glorious day. Clear blue skies with temperatures cooled by a gentle breeze blowing off Elliott Bay and funneling between the high-rises. "God vacations in Seattle in the summer," Kins liked to say.
"But he gets the hell out come October."
At police headquarters, Tracy reached for the glass door and nearly collided with Ron Mayweather and other detectives from the Violent Crimes Section C team, which Mayweather was now calling home. The group looked to be heading off to lunch. "Ron," she said, stepping back to let everyone pass.
"Hey, you got a second?"
"Yeah, sure."
Mayweather looked to the other detectives.
"Save me a seat. I'll catch up with you in a few minutes."
After the others had departed, he turned to Tracy.
"You're in Stevenson, aren't you?"
Foz had nicknamed Mayweather Cotter, because he resembled Gabe Kaplan, the lead actor with the dark curly hair and thick, drooping mustache on the television show Welcome Back, Cotter. Few, however, remembered the show, and those who did remember it didn't remember Kaplan, but a young actor named John Travolta making his television debut. "Just finished all the testimony. Hotig gives his closing at 2.
"How'd it go?"
"Evidence got in. No real surprises." Tracy stepped closer to the side of the building to get out of foot traffic on the sidewalk. "Listen, I'm sorry to keep you."
"Not a problem. What's up?"
"I wanted to ask you about your decision to move to the C team," Tracy said.
"Yeah, sorry I didn't get the chance to talk to you," he said. "It came up quickly. I talked to the other guys, but you were in court."
Tracy folded an errant strand of wind-blown blonde hair behind her ear. "I just wanted to ask why you decided to make the move."
"Why?"
Mayweather chuckled.
"Because Nolasco told me to."
Tracy had not expected the answer.
"He told you to move to C-Team?"
"Yeah,"
Mayweather said, giving her a slight, "what are you going to do?" shrug.
"What exactly did he say?"
"He called me in and said Arroyo was retiring end of the year.
He said he wanted me to start working with him, so I had a feel for his cases and could hit the ground running when he left.
Tracy gave the comment some thought.
You didn't ask to be moved?
No,
Mayweather answered like her question surprised him.
I liked A-Team, even with Fazio giving me shit all the time. I had no idea Arroyo was thinking of retiring. No one did, apparently. Not even the guys on his team.
No?
He said he came to the decision sitting home one night with his wife. He has enough years in to retire on a full pension and wanted to move on with his life.
The sentiment was not unusual. Once a detective had put in the requisite number of years to pull a full pension, the lure of leaving behind the sick and depraved for a more normal life became much more appealing.
Did Nolasco say anything about me being pregnant?
Mayweather smiled. I was wondering when you were going to make that announcement.
You knew? Tracy asked.
Suspected. I think most people suspect.
She wondered if Nolasco was among those people.
But to answer your question, Nolasco didn't say anything. I was wondering whether you'd be coming back after the baby was born, though, whether your spot might open up.
Did you bring that up with Nolasco?
I didn't have to. He said he didn't see a spot opening on A-Team anytime soon, and C-Team needed a detective. You are coming back, aren't you?
That was not what Nolasco had told Kins to justify hiring Gonzalez.
Yeah, she said. Yeah, I intend to come back.
Mayweather smiled.
Good. We'd miss you around here. Anything else?
No, thanks. Sorry to keep you.
No worries, Mayweather said. And he started up the street.
Tracy watched Mayweather go. Her team would miss him. He was dependable and had a good sense of humor. Anyone who could take Dell and Foz's constant ribbing had to have thick skin and a lot of confidence. But that was not what was foremost on Tracy's mind. Nolasco had told her that Mayweather asked to take Arroyo's place because there wouldn't be any openings on the A-Team anytime soon. That had clearly not been what had happened. Nolasco had moved Mayweather to C-Team to open a space for Gonzalez on the A-Team, and Tracy suspected she knew why. Once Tracy took her pregnancy leave, it would be much more difficult for her to argue discrimination if Nolasco replaced her with another woman, especially a minority woman, and he could do so seamlessly if Gonzalez was the A-Team's fifth wheel. Nolasco was covering his ass. She thought of the prior day, when she'd found Gonzalez in Nolasco's office with the door closed, and how Gonzalez had logged on to Tracy's computer and accessed Tracy's reports. That simply wasn't done in violent crimes, and certainly could be interpreted as an indication that Nolasco wanted Gonzalez to take over for Tracy. Then again, maybe Tracy was just being paranoid, sensing conspiracies where none existed.
Maybe.
11. The Volkswagen was registered to Doug and Sandy Blaysmith of Newcastle, Washington, a town neither Dell nor Foz would have predicted for the parked car. First, Newcastle was located 25 to 45 minutes east of South Park, depending on the time of day and the traffic. Second, Newcastle was considered middle to upper middle class, with an average income exceeding $125,000 and home prices of more than $1 million. Newcastle's demographics also had little in common with South Park, with roughly 65% Caucasian and less than 4% Hispanic. The video unit had not been able to pull a plate from the white SUV, the vehicle into which the suspect had climbed. Nor had it been able to find any video of the vehicle on traffic cameras. Foz received the news over the phone shortly after he'd returned to police headquarters, after spending the morning with Vera in the doctor's office. He hadn't wanted to leave her. But Vera had insisted, telling him that nothing good could come from both of them sitting at home worrying. Dell and Foz decided to wait until after 5 p.m. before driving to Newcastle, when it would be more likely the car would be at the house. They also decided not to call the Blaysmith home ahead of time. They used the time to drive back out to South Park to conduct interviews, including questioning the residents of the apartment complex and talking to the businesses that had been closed the previous night, but they didn't find anyone with information about the shooting or any other useful videotapes. While they had been in South Park,
Foz had Andrea Gonzalez put a search warrant together and get it signed by the court in case the Blaysmiths got squirrely. Foz had hoped to get home at a decent hour and spend time with Vera, but he also knew this could be the one break they needed to find Monique Rogers's killer and maybe determine if it had been a hit ordered by Little Jimmy. Before leaving police headquarters, he called home to let Vera know he would be late. True to form, Vera told him to do what he needed to do, and that she'd keep his dinner warm. It was clear to him that she didn't want to talk about the doctor's meeting that morning.
Drugs,
Dell said as they drove to Newcastle. Drugs had been the first theory that came to both their minds for the car being in South Park.
Opioids, meth, maybe heroin.
Maybe, Foz said. He didn't much care about the reason the car had been parked near the shooting, only that it had been. They had bigger fish to fry.
If we nail the shooter, he might start talking. If he does, we could nail Little Jimmy, Dale said from behind the wheel. Wouldn't that be something? Like father, like son.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves, Foz said.
But yeah, that would be something.
The Blaysmiths lived in a suburban development of high-end tract homes not far from the Newcastle Golf Club. Many such developments had been built in the 1980s to accommodate Seattle's expanding population. Functional was the word that came to mind when Foz and Dell drove past the brick wall bearing the development's name and saw homes squeezed together tighter than molars to maximize the number of lots. Creativity and imagination were clearly not exalted here. The homes varied only slightly in the orientation of the buildings on the lots and their floor plans. The exteriors were brick and gray wood siding, and the square footage nearly maxed out the yards, leaving just enough room for a few sculpted hedges and patches of green lawn that could be mowed with two swipes of a mower's blade. Dell parked on a sloped curb in front of the Blaysmiths' two-story home. The base of a basketball hoop was embedded in the sliver of yard separating the property from the neighbors, and the hoop hung out over a pristine driveway, devoid of any cars. Foz hoped the Jetta was parked in one of the three garage bays. Otherwise, it had been a long trip for nothing. They donned their sport coats and walked a brick path to a beveled glass door beneath a 12-foot entry. The weather felt warmer than it had in Seattle, despite the shade of trees looming behind the roofline. Dell rang the doorbell, setting off a series of chimes, followed instantly by the barking of what sounded like a large dog.
$10 says it's a Labrador.
Dell removed his sunglasses and slipped them inside his coat pocket.
Too easy, Foz said.
Specify, yellow, black, or brown. He kept his gaze directed at the door.
Yellow. Definitely yellow.
I might as well just give you the $10 now, Foz said. A woman pulled open the door, holding the collar of a very excited yellow lab. The dog looked like he was trying to fly, his front legs elevated and swiping at the air, tongue hanging from the side of his mouth. Dell gave Foz a subtle smirk.
Can I help you? The woman asked.
Sandy Blaysmith appeared to be mid-40s and impeccably put together, in tight jeans, black ankle boots, and a blouse with a plunging neckline that revealed a freckled chest and a gold necklace. Rings adorned several fingers, some with impressive stones. Before Foz could respond, she yelled at the dog, tugging on the animal's collar.
Sit, Seeger, sit! Sit!
The dog ignored her, continuing to whine and paw at the air.
I'm sorry, but if you're selling anything, we're not interested, and you really don't want me to let my dog go. He bites.
It was a bluff, and not a very good one. The only damage Seeger looked capable of causing was to knock them down and lick them to death. Foz held up his badge.
We're with the Seattle Police Department. Are you Sandy Blaysmith?
The woman went from looking exasperated to looking concerned.
What is this about?
Maybe you could lock the dog out back, Dell suggested.
Hang on, she said.
She yanked the dog inside and flung the door shut. Foz heard her yell to her husband over the dog's barking.
Doug, come take your dog and put him in the backyard. I need you to get your dog and put him in the backyard.
Not an animal lover, Foz said.
Definitely not, Dell said.
Because there are two Seattle police officers at the front door, Sandy hollered. Two police officers.
I don't know. Just take Seeger and put him out back.
Del looked at Foz. Double or nothing. They also have a cat, a son, and a daughter. Instant family. Just add water.
I won't take that bet, Foz said.
The door reopened. This time, Sandy was...